get in the habit of really critically evaluating what's being said. What is the data? Are they doing a legitimate study, and are they giving a legitimate interpretation of that data? That's my take-home message. Think very critically about scientific information.
Welcome back to Lunchtime Leaders Podcast. Today we'll be interviewing Dr. Sharon McKay, a research associate from Yale University's School of Medicine. Welcome, Mrs. McKay.
Hi.
What type of research are you involved in?
Well, I manage a lab that does research on the role and mechanism of mitochondrial gene expression. So mitochondria are organelles in cells, and they have their own DNA, and they express genes off that DNA independently of the DNA in the nucleus. So we're interested in how they do that.
What diseases do you think the DNA mutations in the mitochondria are responsible for? Which diseases are you closest to figuring out?
Well, the mitochondrial DNA is inherited from your mom. And so specific diseases due to certain mutations can be inherited. And there are a number of different diseases that can be inherited that way. They usually have effects on the nervous system and on muscle function. But more importantly, I think, is DNA mutations accumulate in mitochondrial DNA over the lifespan. So as you get older, your mitochondrial DNA gets more and more mutations, and that can affect the function of mitochondria. And it's thought that that gives rise to many of the symptoms of aging, if you will, many of the things that start to happen as you get older that aren't so much fun. So,
has the whole sequence of DNA in the mitochondria been mapped?
Oh, yes. It was mapped quite a long time ago, actually. The mitochondrial DNA is fairly small. It's a circular molecule, sort of like the DNA in a bacterium, and it has about 16,300 base pairs versus the trillions of base pairs that are in the nucleus. So it was actually mapped back in the, I think, in the 1970s.
Has it helped you?
Oh, yes. We need to know exactly what each nucleotide is so that we can understand the effects of specific mutations.
We also read some of your research on brain plasticity.
Oh.
And need some advice.
Okay.
With all of our big tests coming up, can you give us some advice on increasing our brain plasticity? Actually, before the advice, can you explain to our listeners what brain plasticity means?
Sure. Well, neuronal plasticity refers to the fact that neurons have formed synaptic connections with one another, and that's how information gets relayed in the brain, from one neuron to another via these synapses. Memory formation is thought to rely on synapse formation and on the strengthening or weakening of certain synaptic structures. So brain plasticity, in terms of memory, would be that you would want to increase the number or the strength of synapses that you're forming as you're learning new material. And one of the best ways to do that is to practice, and that is, if you're learning something for a test, you should study it several times with breaks in between. We found that's one of the best ways to retain information for the long term is to learn it and then take a break and do something else and then learn it again and then take a break and do something else and then learn it again. So practice, practice, practice is my advice.
What made you interested in becoming a scientist?
Well, when I was younger, I was actually in nursing school for a little while, and I was studying psychiatric nursing. And I found that the patient populations that I dealt with, particularly schizophrenics, I was very interested in the fact that their view of reality and of the world was so different from mine. And yet we were sitting right in the same room. And I realized that the brain really creates this sense of reality and the sense of where we are. And that idea captivated me. I found it just so fascinating that I wanted to learn more and more about it. So it was really an idea that drew me into science.
What are the challenges facing you as a female scientist?
Well, I think there are two challenges for female scientists. One is a challenge for any woman who's working, and that is, of course, having children. Because at the time in your life when you're young enough and energetic enough to have children, that's usually the time in your work career that you're trying to make a name for yourself. So having children is by far the biggest problem for all women who work, and especially for scientists, because you are having to be in the lab for long hours, and it's hard sometimes to, you know, get married and have a successful relationship when you're at that good childbearing age. The other is, I think, that science, although it's changing now, science has traditionally been pretty male-dominated. Now, there are a lot more women in science now, and like I said, things are changing. But that male-dominated aspect of science, I think, creates a culture in the scientific workplace that is very focused on the individual, on being very aggressive. And some of these traits are things that women aren't always very comfortable with. So sometimes the women will not be as successful as men simply because they may not be as aggressive or because they prefer to work in groups rather than alone. So I think those are some challenges that women face in science. But again, these things are all changing.
We have a question from a listener, and his question is, why do breaks when studying help with memory retention?
That's because when your synapses are being strengthened, at least this is true in models from of organisms, like lower organisms. What we know about is mainly from lower organisms. As your synapses are being strengthened, there is a time lag between the initial event that needs to be strengthened and the delivery of the material to the synapse to make the synapse stronger. And it's thought that some of the advantage of the breaks is because it gives you that synapse that you're trying to strengthen time to remodel. Then you go in and hit it again with that same event, that same information, and that sort of reinforces the remodeling and orders some more stuff down to, you know, remodel it even further and make it a little bit stronger.
Does mitochondrial DNA get mutations in the same way that nucleus DNA does?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, it does. But there's another way that mitochondrial DNA can be mutated that nuclear DNA isn't as susceptible to, that's even more important. So certainly there are a lot of chemicals that cause mutations, and those things can affect mitochondrial and nuclear DNA. In fact, some of the chemicals that cause mutations in nuclear DNA are actually, those chemicals accumulate even more in the mitochondria. But the other thing that happens in mitochondria is, because mitochondria are making ATP through oxidative phosphorylation, that process, which involves electron transport, you may have read about this, you probably read about some of this in your biology classes in school, that process of electron transport is sometimes not as efficient as it should be. And so free electrons can escape the electron transport chain. And when they do that, they react with oxygen that's nearby, and they create reactive oxygen species. Now, reactive oxygen species are very damaging to DNA and to proteins, but especially to DNA. They can induce mutations. And because this happens in the mitochondria, and the mitochondria DNA is sitting right there, mitochondrial DNA is very susceptible to the effects of reactive oxygen species.
What skills or abilities do you feel students need to have to be successful in the 21st century?
Well, I think that one important skill, and this isn't just a 21st century skill, this is in general, is really the ability to critically evaluate information. You need to be able to, especially in science, when somebody says, I found this, here's my result, you need to really say, how do you know that? Well, what's your, you know, is your evidence valid and is it reliable? So critical thinking is very important. For the 21st century, I think that the ability to work very well with computers and with large databases is really a very important skill. There's a lot of DNA sequence in these huge databases, and there are a lot of microarray analyses where people look at the expression patterns of thousands and thousands of genes at one time under different conditions. And if people who can go in and extract meaningful information from those sorts of databases, I think will always have a real advantage in science.
Looking at the people you currently see entering your field, what are their strengths and what are their weaknesses?
Well, I definitely think, the biggest strength, of course, is to be able to ask a good question and critically evaluate the answers that you're getting. The other thing is, a lot of the newer students coming in now are really good at dealing with these computer databases. They do this, we have a guy in my lab right now who just did a very nice, what they're calling an in silico analysis. So, you know, there's in vivo, meaning that you're studying something in a live organism, and in vitro means you're studying something in glass, and usually means you're studying like cells in a culture dish. And in silico now means you're going into the computer databases and you're extracting information. And so I think that's one of the biggest strengths for the new students coming in, is that they really know how to handle this kind of information and how to extract meaningful ideas and information out of the databases.
What are your thoughts regarding how much we should focus on content knowledge versus focusing on students' ability to learn, adapt, grow?
And this is my favorite question of the questions that you sent me. I really love this question. I want to tell you that if we go back for a second to my plasticity work, I'm going to tell you that because you're very young right now, you have the best neural plasticity you're ever going to have. So I would urge you to learn content as much as possible now while you're young, and while it's easy to learn, and while you'll never forget it. Having said that, I think if you want to be successful in science, as you're learning content, you want to be critically evaluating it too. You want to be asking, how did they know that? What was the experiment they did to find that out? So you kind of need to do both, I guess. But because you're young, learn as much content as you possibly can now, because it gets harder and harder as you get older.
Considering the work environment in your field, how important is it for kids to be working in groups in school?
Yeah, that was also a really good question. So in science, as I mentioned before, the sort of old-fashioned science lab was one where everybody worked very much on their own. People were pretty isolated. And there are still a lot of people like to do that, but more and more people, certainly in biological sciences, there are a lot more women now, more and more people are interested in trying to collaborate more and trying to work in groups. In addition, there's just so much more known now that you just can't do everything yourself anymore. So it's really good to be able to collaborate and work in groups. So I would say that it's more important to learn how to work as a group, to learn how to value the contributions of each person without being derisive about maybe the things that they're not aware of, and sort of train each other, teach each other, and try to create a good scientific outcome from the group. That's sort of the bottom line, right? You want a good result, and it doesn't really matter so much whether it's one person or four people who work together who get it.
Do you specifically work in a group, or do you work by yourself?
Well, we have different ideas about that in my lab, actually. I have a project that I'm working on that's my own project, but I actually like to collaborate with the other people in the lab as much as I can. I prefer working with other people and not being isolated on my own.
What is the project you're working on?
Well, my project is on a mitochondrial DNA mutation that causes deafness. So we know that there's a mutation in the mitochondrial DNA that's inherited from the mother, and some people it causes them to lose their hearing spontaneously, and in other people it causes them to lose their hearing in response to being treated with certain types of antibiotics. And so we're interested in why. We know that the mutation causes some disruptions in gene expression in both the mitochondria and in the nucleus, oddly enough. And so we're interested in how that results in deafness.
What was the best learning or educational experience you have had?
Well, as far as science goes, I would say that the best learning experiences are usually what we call journal clubs. So this is pretty common in science labs. I don't know if you guys do this at school or not, but in every lab I've ever been affiliated with, there's one day a week where everybody gets together, they take a paper that's recently come out in the literature, some scientific result that someone's published, and you just start analyzing it and critically evaluating it and taking it apart. How did they do the experiment? Is that a legitimate way to do the experiment? How did they interpret their data? Is that interpretation valid? Are there alternative interpretations? Those are really the best scientific learning experiences I've ever had in journal clubs.
When we're done today, what's the most important takeaway message you'd like our teachers and students to hear?
Well, I'd say that in terms of a scientific career, and actually maybe just in general, this is important. I say get in the habit of really critically evaluating scientific information when you come across it. If you're in science, you'll be doing that anyway because you have to always critically evaluate other people's research. But even when you're reading the paper and you're reading about some new finding that says that some dietary component causes this disease or that disease, get in the habit of really critically evaluating what's being said. What is the data? Are they doing a legitimate study, and are they giving a legitimate interpretation of that data? That's my take-home message. Think very critically about scientific information.
Well, thank you very much for coming to our show, Dr. McKay.
Thank you.
Before we go, we would like to plug next week's show. We will be interviewing many of school's Teachers of the Year nominees. We live all together for our second from last podcast. Only 2 more to go before we leave for high school. Our last show, we will have a very, very special guest. So you will not want to miss it.